All right, so good afternoon. We are made it up to the Book of Psalms, the 19th book in the order. Spent quite a few weeks on Job, and so we will probably spend quite a few weeks in Psalms. I think the plan will be to do 2 weeks of Psalms and then alternate with another book just to try to break it up, so it won't be quite as tedious or difficult. Not that we should get bored, but if you're like me, you're reading poetry, you know, that's all you're doing for 15 weeks straight, it might be difficult to maintain attention and focus. So, the Book of Psalms, it is a collection of psalms. It's pretty clear it's not all written by the same penman. It is not easy to identify who wrote each particular psalm. I counted up 56 psalms that have a title that calls itself a psalm. Just did a word search for the word psalm and saw what showed up in the first verse. And so quite a few of them will say a psalm of David, but that's 56 out of 150, where it's either got some other title or no title at all. And so a lot are attributed to David, but there's really just a lot of guessing and conjecture. Sometimes from context you can figure it out, but, I'm not going to guess if I don't know. So the word psalm has always been kind of fuzzy in my head. So if you look up the Hebrew word, the word is mizmor. It comes from a root word that's a verb that has two different meanings. The first one means it's used to cut or to prune, and that's Strong's number 2168. And then there's also Strong's 2167, same spelling, same word, two different meanings. The other meaning is to strike strings or to play music. So you can think of that expression, striking up a band. So the idea between those two definitions, a psalm is poetry. But it is, it's got short sentences, like you're cutting or pruning. It's divided syllables, and Hebrew obviously doesn't translate quite the same way in English. But they were set to music. They had musical notes. What the music was now is, we don't know. So I won't even try to guess, but it was adapted for singing. Now, that being said, I just said I won't try and guess. You know, there are still, rabbis who will chant the Psalms, and it's kind of a form of singing. They don't know what the original tune was, but I'm just going to play one of those just so you can get an idea of one way. Syrian version of the melody. I found another version, and this is a younger fellow plays a piano, so it's a musical instrument that's accompanying it. And he does kind of like a call and chant back with Hebrew and then English. So you might enjoy this a little bit more. I kind of skipped through his intro stuff, but it's set to kind of a peppy tune. And so, anyway, just giving you just another way that folks are still trying to sing Psalms today.
Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked. He doesn't stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. Betorat Adonai Chepzo, Ubetorato, Yerikeo Mamba Laila. But only in the law of the Lord is his delight, and in his law he meditates day and night. And he will be like a tree planted by streams of water, which will give its fruit in its season, and its leaf will not wither, and all which he does will prosper. Not so the wicked, but they are as the chaff which the wind drives about. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the company of the righteous. Ki yodea Adonai derech tzadikim vederech reshaim tovim.
Y'all got a kick out of those. As I said, long story short, we don't know what the tunes are, but as you're reading them, remember that they were set to music. And that can help us later as we get on, as we try to think about some of these words that we don't use very often, like Selah. So let's jump in and let's look at Psalm 1. We just listened to it. I didn't get anything out of listening to him here in Hebrew. I like the sound of it. But the only thing that I picked up was I recognized one word, and that was Torah. And that shows up in verse 2. And that's the Hebrew word for law. So the Torah can often be used to reference the first five books of the Bible, which Moses was the penman, or it can be used to reference just his law in general. So Torah. So that was neat. All right, so Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. One quick observation. Notice the way that this psalm starts compared with the Sermon on the Mount. You've got the blessed is, and you fill in the blank. You can see that over in Matthew, I believe. have my notes all handy and ready. Matthew 5, verses 3 through 11. All right, so very similar to the way Jesus structured the Sermon on the Mount. But we're talking about the blessed man. Blessed means happy. Happy is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. So we got three different actions: walking, standing, and sitting. All right, so the walking, if you look at that word, it literally translates to following or behaving. You're not engaging in actions. And what kind of actions? Those that are advised, counsel, and the advice of the ungodly. Ungodly translates to the morally wrong. You are not following the advice of the morally wrong. All right, so the happy is the man who doesn't take counsel from the ungodly and certainly doesn't follow it. Nor do you stand in the way of sinners. The way is often used to describe paths or roads or routes of sinners. Sinners are the guilty. So the ungodly, the sinners, and the scornful are all describing the same people. These are worldly people who are in enmity with God. And so you're not standing in their way. So you're not only you're not following after their counsel, you're not abiding in the same paths that they take, the routes that they take, the pathways, the courses of life. You're not staying there. Right? It's one thing if you have to cross over their route, but it's another to be staying in it, to continuing down that path, not only walking or just being there at a fixed point. And that point carries on to the third one, nor sitting in the seat of the scornful. Sitting, you know, obviously it's a more permanent form of dwelling. You're remaining there long term. So you're not following their advice down the road, down the path. You're not staying there in the short term. You're not living there in the long term. And the seat is the site or the abode, the houses. So you're not listening to their counsel. You're not following their paths. And nor are you, you know, abiding in their homes. A godly man, the blessed man, is going to avoid all those things. So sum it all up in one word: avoid evil associations in all forms. Don't act like they're not going to affect you. I'm too good. This won't bother me. This is saying don't, any way, shape, form, or fashion. Okay. So that's the negative things that the blessed man's doing. He's avoiding those three, and then you get two positive things that he is doing. The happy man, his delight is the law of the Lord. So it's your word Torah. His delight, his pleasure is the law of the Lord, God's word. That's his light, his delight, his pleasure. And in his law he doth meditate day and night. And the daily and the day and night translate to daily and nightly. So every day and every night you are meditating. You're murmuring to yourself is what it literally translates to: murmur or to ponder on his word. It's a delight, it's a pleasure. That man is happy. The happy man is able to have pleasure in the law of the Lord. And because of that, you get into verse 3, you get this imagery. All right? It's poems, right? So one of the images, we're going to get a word picture comparing the godly, righteous, happy man who's delighted in the law of the Lord compared to those sinners, ungodly, scornful folk. One is going to be like a tree. And imagine, you know, I'm down here in an agrarian society, it seems like, and so trees are a lot more important, particularly pecan trees. You need enough water to make sure they produce. Well, the righteous man, he's going to be like a tree planted by a river of water. This is not a small stream. This is not something that's dependent on rain to continue to flow. It's something that's always going to have a water source. Because of that, he'll consistently bring forth his fruit in the season. His leaves won't wither and dry, and whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. Now, often when we read this, we're tempted to go to that prosper to think of material wealth, right? Well, that doesn't fit in with our image. In our image, we're a tree. We're bringing forth fruit, we're leaves that won't wither, and then so prosper. If you look at the Hebrew word prosper, it literally means to push. So you think about putting forth new growth, new branches that you're pushing out, it'll succeed. Whereas when you dry up, you don't have any water, and during a drought, your leaves wither and your branches shrivel up and curl up and you die, right? Well, the righteous man, he's got stability. He has an enduring source of nutrition, and this is referring to the spiritual life, just referring to God feeding and supplying the spiritual man. So that's one image. You've got this strong, tall tree planted by waters that's going to be sustained. He's stable. And then the contrary to that image is the image of the ungodly. So the ungodly aren't like that at all, right? They're not so. but they are like the chaff which is driven by the wind. Now, you and I have not had to thresh or beat out wheat anytime recently. Process is you harvest the grain, and back then you'd have to take the grain and you have to smack it with sticks until the thin little husk would come off. And then you would fan it and the husk would blow away. Well, the husks are called chaff. So for our purposes, just imagine it's just dried up shell, something that's, or leaves that are so lightweight and worthless and vain, but it's so light that the wind can just blow it away. So the ungodly are like that, that lightweight little worthless chaff or shells that aren't sustained. They're not stable. They're not being provided like that strong tree with the water. Right? So those are your two images. You've got the blessed man. What are the actions he's not engaging in? What are the things that he is doing? Just obviously focusing on the law of the Lord. He's sustained. The ungodly are not so. They're going to be blown away like the chaff of the wind. And then in verse 5, you get to jumping forward to the final judgment. Therefore, the ungodly are not so, but are like the chaff of the wind, or but are like chaff, which the wind driveth away. Therefore, whenever you see a therefore in Scripture, you've got to go back and see, what is he therefore? Therefore, because they're like chaff, they shall not stand in the judgment. And stand literally means to arise up or to be successful. They will not be able to stand with their heads held high at the final judgment because they're not being sustained by God. It says, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. We get the image in Matthew about Jesus at the final judgment dividing his children from those that are not, the sheep and the goats. There will not be a single goat who slips into the sheepfold. You're departing to the left and the right. There's not going to be any cutting in line or trying to get over, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. That's what it's referring to. The sinners being the goats, the wicked, the ungodly, and the righteous, those that Jesus died for and are born again in this life and serve God by the new will that he gives us. The ungodly will not stand in the judgment. They're going to perish. They will not enter into heaven, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. So there will be no slipping in goats in the sheepfold. For, which again reflects back to the previous thing, it won't happen. For the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. So he knows the end of our path, all the way down our life, beyond death, at the resurrection. He knows the whole way of the righteous. And for every single one of God's children, the way ends with God, at God, in his presence. The way of the ungodly, it says, shall perish. For the word perish literally means to be lost, which implies as being destroyed. And so, as we looked at in Job, the ungodly may not have all the vengeance poured out upon them in this world that they deserve, and that we would maybe like to see. But the end of their path, the way, the road that they're traveling down, the end will be to be lost. And we refer to that as hell, the utter separation from God for eternity. Psalm 1. I'm going to pause. All right. We're going to skip 2 and come back to that if we have time. I don't want to give it short shrift because there's a lot going on in there. We might spend more time than we have, but I want to at least get through 3, 4, and 5 before we come back to it. So jumping forward to Psalm 3. You can't see it on this version, on this online version. But in most of your Bibles, above verse 1, there should be a little caption that says, a psalm of David when he fled from Absalom his son. That's in the original text. That wasn't added by someone else later. And so that was one of the times when I was looking for, doing a word search for psalm. So this is the first one. This is the first psalm that has a title. It is titled A Psalm of David. So who wrote it? David. And it gives you the context. Nicely enough, when he fled from Absalom his son. So, quick refresher, David messed up by taking a young woman, Bathsheba. He took her to his bed, got her impregnated, and found out about it. He tried to have the husband set up so it looked like it was his kid. The husband wouldn't do that, so he had the husband killed, and then later took her as his wife. God sent a prophet named Nathan to call him out of that. And one of his punishments was that he was going to have like turmoil and warfare, and specifically one of his own household was going to rise up against him. That came to be in the name, in the form of his son Absalom. Absalom had an issue with his brother, who terribly raped Absalom's sister, that guy's half-sister. And so Absalom had him killed, or killed him, rather. And then he was banished for a time, and then Absalom came back. And then while Absalom came back after his banishment, he instituted kind of a long-term conspiracy where he started working to get everyone in the country to be more in favor of him being king. And so finally, he pulled the trigger. This is all in 2 Samuel chapters 15 through 19, so you can go read that to kind of see the whole matter on Absalom and the issues with Bathsheba with 2 Samuel 12. Long story short, Absalom does engage in a conspiracy. He's successful enough to cause the king, David, and a lot of his family and courtiers, whatnot, had to flee from Jerusalem to avoid, you know, Absalom coming with his army to kill him. And so you can read the path that he fled by, going down and over the brook Kidron and up the Mount of Olives. That's the same path that Jesus would later take. David wound up having to have this whole civil war with those who are following Absalom and those who are still loyal to the king. And so, obviously, a very, very, very troubling time. And so he is writing a psalm now, probably in the midst of that or remembering that. So jumping into it, it says, Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him. Selah. All right. So this is probably thinking about the scope of this conspiracy. It's not just his son. His son has got some top, you know, military leaders on his side. He's got David's favorite counselor, Ahithophel. Anyway, there's just a lot of people that he's discovering are against him, that there's many of them that are going to fight a war. And not only that, but they're willing to go against David because they believe that God's not going to deliver David. Now, God had given the kingdom to David and had been with him and preserved him from all the years where Saul was trying to kill him for perceived slights and really just lack of trust. But these men, these conspirators, think that God's not going to deliver him, not going to help him. Many there be which say to my soul, there is no help for him in God. Selah. All right, what is Selah? Selah, according to Strong's, if you look that up, it's number 5542, it is a suspension, specifically suspension of music here in this context. This word is only used in the book of Psalms and in the book of Habakkuk. It appears three times in the book of Habakkuk. The root word it comes from means to hang or hang up, contemn, or to tread down. So I guess you're pausing the music, and I believe it's giving you an opportunity to just chew on what was just said. And so if we're pausing in our music, David is just lamented to the Lord. He's got so many enemies that they're rising up against him, and they think that there's no help for me in God. Just chewing on that. How bad and how bleak does that go? And so that's just kind of, you know, lingering out there. And then you get into verse 3 with a but. Now, when we're in our lives, when we use but, it's often here's something and then I'm going to give you some bad news in this but. In the Bible, there's sometimes that happens. But I like to look for the positive ones where it's but God. And so this one, it goes, But thou, O Lord. So the men are against me. It's negative. It's very bad. I'm very distressed on this. But thou. And he shifts. And he's looking at God. Says, but O Lord. That's Jehovah. Because it's in all caps. Lord. Art a shield for me. My glory. And the lifter up of my head. So there's three things that he's ascribing unto God. Is a shield. His protector. His defender. My glory. Or my majesty. My honor. And then the one who raises up my head, you know, the one who's going to deliver me, you know, if I'm focusing on myself, and I'm discouraged, and my head's hanging down, but God is able to raise his head up to give him confidence that the Lord will take care of him. Many kings would trust in their armies or their horses or their castles for their shield and their riches for their glory and for their own arm for lifting up their head. But David, being a man after God's own heart, is ascribing all those things. He knows that they really all come from the Lord. And so he's putting emphasis where it needs to be in the one who has the ability to help him. It says, I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. Notice that's past tense. He has cried unto the Lord. He heard me out of his holy hill. And hill could also be translated as mountain, his sanctified or holy mountain. It's a good way of referring to heaven. He's heard me. Selah. So pause again. So your first pause was about how bad it is. Now you're pausing about, I recognize, Lord, you're my shield, my glory, my lifter up my head. I cried unto you, and you heard me. That's encouraging. That's good. Chew on that. Because he heard me, you get into verse 5. I laid me down and slept and awakened, for the Lord sustained me. The Lord, he had confidence and security, knowing that he could lay down and rest. He did not have to stay up at night worrying about this conspiracy that these folks were trying to kill him, because it wasn't up to him. He knew that the Lord was sustaining him. The Lord sustained me. I laid me down. I slept and I awakened. Knowing all that, he's got confidence in verse 6 that he doesn't have to be afraid. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people. Notice the S on the thousands. It's not just 10,000 around me. 10,000s. So that could be 100,000. That's 10,000s, right? That's a bold statement. That's big. And as children of God, as followers of God, we can say the same thing. We don't have to be afraid of tens of thousands of people, even if they're setting themselves around me. And you think about the wagon trains out on the Oregon Trail, and they'd circle the wagons, and they're inside the wagons, and then the bandits or Indians or whoever was attacking them was on the outside. If you had this massive host around you, you still don't have to be afraid, even if you're completely encircled. And then he's going to ask for something. He's going to petition in verse 7. It says, arise, O Lord, save me, deliver me. Save literally means to provide an open way. Path where he's in is narrow or straight, and he doesn't have an escape. Open up a way, a path of deliverance. Oh, arise, O Lord, and save me. O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone, thou hast broken the teeth of the ungodly. All right, so notice again, this is past tense. He is drawing upon the experiences of how God has delivered him in the past. When he had all these enemies before that were withstanding him, God, it means literally like he punched him in the face. Right? He broke him, he's hit him upon the cheekbone, it's broken the teeth of the ungodly. That could be in the same illusion of hitting a human's teeth or face from the punch, but also there's imagery throughout scripture of teeth referring to power, and specifically it's used for young lions. You are breaking the power of the enemy, the same way that when a young lion breaks his teeth, he's no longer powerful. I saw a documentary about this lion walking around with one tooth that's just hanging down, snaggle tooth, and he couldn't fight anymore, and eventually he got overtaken. But he is ascribing the deliverance of these previous trials to God. And then in verse 8, he's recognizing that salvation belongs to the Lord, and thy blessing is upon thy people. So where's deliverance going to come from? It's going to come from God. Even if he's in the middle of this trial right now and doesn't know how it's going to end, he knows that God is in control, that he is the provider of safety and the glory that David had in his kingdom, and he's the one who's going to deliver him. And so the salvation belongs unto him, and that thy blessings are upon thy people. All right, and then Selah. I'll pause it one more time. All right, so jumping down to Psalm 4. Again, this doesn't have the title on the screen. I'm sorry about that. But it says, to the chief musician on the Neganoth, a Psalm of David. Okay, well, what in the world is a neganoth? And if you look up that, it says it is a stringed musical instrument. Properly, it literally means an instrumental music, but from that you imply that it's a string musical instrument. So this particular psalm written by David was designed to be, you know, sang in accompaniment with a string musical instrument. All right. And that neganoth, that is used 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different times in the Psalms. 4, 6, 54, 55, 61, 67, and 76. Right. So we start off with a request. He's addressing God. This psalm is going to shift the audience who David's talking to, or who our psalmist is talking to. It says, "Hear me when I call, O God, of my righteousness. Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress. Have mercy upon me and hear my prayer." All right, so he's starting with a request of, "Hear me. Hear me when I call, when I cry unto you, when I pray unto you, O God of my righteousness." Only righteousness we have is only from God. "Thou hast enlarged me when I was in distress." So he is reminding God of the deliverances that God's already given him. And then he's asking to have mercy upon me and hear my prayer. All right, so hear me when I call, hear my prayer, have mercy upon me. And then he shifts his attention and he lives a new audience, and that is to men. Could be to his enemies or could be men in general. It says, "Oh, sons of men, how long will you turn my glory into shame? How long will you love vanity and seek after leasing?" Selah. All right. So what's he talking about here? He's talking about men who are lying about David. I don't know if you've ever had anyone lie about something you've done or said, whether, and specifically, you know, really with intention, not someone just misheard and they're spreading rumors, but somebody knew what you said and they twisted it and they wanted you to look bad. How long will you turn my glory into shame? So things, you know, no good deed goes unpunished. Sometimes that's how it shakes out. Because these men are saying, are turning, you know, glories, good things about David, and they're describing them and they're turning them to shame or falsehoods. How will you love vanity? That's idle or worthless words, and seek after leasing. Leasing is lies. Okay. How long are you going to do this? That's the question. Selah, pause, chew on that. How long are you going to do that? I'm praying to God, men, how long are you going to continue to lie, specifically lie about me? And then he gives them a teaching, an understanding they need to know. It says, "But know," apparently they don't already know this, but they need to know, "but know that the Lord hath set apart him that is godly for himself. The Lord will hear when I call unto him." So this is a teaching about the Lord taking his children, setting them apart. They're different. And that the Lord's going to hear David. He's one of his. He is a man after his own heart. He says, "The Lord will hear me when I call." So, y'all who continue to tell lies about me, I have a direct line to the boss, right? He's going to hear when I call. And then he gives them an opportunity, an exhortation, a call to repent. It says, "Stand in awestruck or terrified even, and sin not." Stand still, stop what you're doing, be amazed, and sin not. You need to commune with your own heart, think in your own heart, on your bed, and be still. Selah. Offer the sacrifices of righteousness and put your trust in the Lord, as opposed to putting your trust in yourself. And so he's giving them verses 4 and 5 of, y'all need to stop what you're doing, and you need to be still, chew on it in your own heart, think about that, and then you need to offer the sacrifices of righteousness, do the works of righteousness, particularly rather than lip service or overt acts of wickedness. Put your trust in the Lord. So they should, he's admonishing them to act godly. "There be many that say, who will show us any good?" Right? "The Lord, Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance." So I think here, "there be many that say, who will show us any good?" That is the wicked men talking. The ones that are telling lies about him, they're asking, who's going to show us any good? Basically, what's the benefit? You know, like we saw in Job, what's the benefit of the righteous serving God? You know, who's going to show us any good? And then David shifts his attention back to God and prays, "Lord, lift thou up the light of thy countenance upon us." What does that mean? Show us the light of your face. Countenance is your face. Show us you know, your beauty, your glory, your majesty, show us your favor, shining upon us, that who can show us any good? God is the one who's able to show good. He's able to rain down blessings from heaven, and it's not just in form of material blessings, as we'll see in verse 7. It says, thou hast put gladness in my heart more than in a time that their corn and their wine increase. Notice the there. The there are referring to material blessings when the world they get excited and they're happy, right? He's saying that the Lord, you put in gladness in me more than they ever got, more than they ever understood, and it wasn't because you're blessing me materially. I will lay me down in sleep, in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. So when the Lord shines his light and countenance upon his people, he can give them gladness, a joy of heart, that they can rejoice, they can lay down and rest with peace and sleep, even though trials are still going on. The enemies haven't gone away yet, but he can still rejoice, and he can still have the gladness that comes from him, more than, you know, all the vain joy that comes from, you know, times when your corn and wine increase. I mean, if you ever had that bumper year, we got the big bonus, or, you know, the household, or whatever you wanted it to, it's just like, you know, oh, yeah, and you're really excited. I'm saying the gladness from the Lord that the Lord put in his heart is way more than that, more than their corn, more than when their corn and wine are increased. So I will lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me to dwell in safety. So he's, you know, starting with prayer, hear my prayer, asking how long is this trial going to go on, you men who are being so evil against me. But he's teaching them. He's got an answer for them. You really ought not be acting like this. The Lord sets apart his own. He's going to hear them. You need to do what's right. Put your trust in the Lord. Because he's going to sustain me. He makes me to dwell in safety. All right. All right, Psalm 5, to the chief musician upon the Nehiloth. Yeah, Nehiloth. What's a Nehiloth? According to Strong's, that's a flute. It only appears one time in this psalm. So, 4 was to a string musical instrument, and this one's like a flute. Get the woodwinds. All right. This is another psalm of David, and it starts off, give ear to my words, O Lord, consider my meditation. Now, this is similar to 4, and it's asking for God to hear what he's about to say. Listen to what I'm saying. Consider my words. Consider my meditations, my ponderings, the things that I've been uttering or chewing on in my heart. So it's got 2 requests. Give ear, consider, it's another way of listening. And then verse 2 starts again with hearken unto the voice of my cry. You got 3 requests for him to hear. Hear, 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 hear. Who do you want to hear? I want my God and my king and my God to hear. For unto thee will I play. And that God there is plural. My king and my God, for unto thee will I pray. So he is going to the source, the one who is able to address the matter, as opposed to so often where we just want to complain to our friends or to ourselves or get down and despondent. Hearken unto the voice of my cry. And that word cry has got a great definition. It means a halloo. If y'all remember Mary Poppins with the fox and the hounds and everybody's chasing it. And they're like, oh, yes, woo, halloo, woo, halloo. You know, they're hollering, shouting. So there's one sense where you talk about we're praying to the Lord, but there's another one where it's crying out. I don't know if you've ever cried out in anguish or despair or fear to the Lord. That's more akin to what David's here. Hearken unto the voice of my cry, my halloo. You know, hear me, my king and my God, for unto thee will I pray. All right. My voice shalt thou hear in the morning. So you've got the dedication, prayerfulness. He's rising up and starting his prayers. O Lord, in the morning will I direct my prayer unto thee and will look up. I think there's a lot of good admonitions in Scripture about looking up and reminding us how much greater God is than us, rather than looking down and what we can control. what we think we can control. I'll direct my prayer unto thee, and I will look up. And then he describes some attributes of God. He says, thou art not a God that hath pleasure in wickedness, neither shall evil dwell with thee. The foolish shall not stand in thy sight. Thou hatest all workers of iniquity. So he is, you know, positively affirming that God hates workers of iniquity. He hates evil. The foolish are not going to be able to stand. Going back to the ungodly standing in the congregation of the righteous, they're not going to stand. And neither shall the evil dwell with thee. They won't be there in heaven. They're going to be eternally lost and separated from him. And he doesn't have pleasure in wickedness. I think it's important for us to remember, particularly now, that the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God. Right? We don't please God by our wrath. To the foolish shall not stand in thy sight, thou hatest all workers of iniquity. Thou shalt destroy them that speak leasing. Again, leasing is the King James Version word for means lies. And the Lord will abhor the bloody and deceitful man. So that's all describing the evil and the wickedness. And David is recognizing those things don't please you. And then you get into a but. This is not as great as a but God, but this is a but me. But as for me, I will continue into thy house in the multitude of thy mercies. It's going into the sanctuary. Back then, it was the tabernacle. The temple hadn't been built yet by David. It's not built by his son. As for me, I will come into thy house in the multitude of thy mercy, and in thy fear, I will worship towards thy holy temple. That's referring to worshiping towards God's habitation in heaven. Lead me, O Lord, guide me in thy righteousness, not my own righteousness, but your righteousness. And because of mine enemies, make thy way straight before my face. Make thy way, thy path, thy determination for how I need to live my life. What's my next step? So make my way straight and clear and put it right before my face. Because I got enemies who are all around me who are trying to throw me off. Verse 9 says, for there's no faithfulness in their mouth. Their inward part is very wicked. Their throat is an open sepulcher. They flatter with the tongue. This is a description of those enemies that are about him. You can't trust what they say. You know, everything about them is wicked, and their mouth, their throat, it says it's like it's an open sepulcher. Well, sepulcher, that's a grave. It's like, you know, they're as helpful as trying to throw you down a grave. But they flatter with their tongue, so you know, they're slick. They're saying one thing and meaning another, and so because of all this confusion and bad advice and counsel that's being given and pushed against him, he's asking God, Lord, make my way straight. Put it before my face. Show me what the next step is. Now, when you're praying for the Lord to show you your path, don't pray for him to show the whole path, because guess what? He ain't going to. You may get the next stepping stone or the next two, but pray for the one that's right there before your face. That's the one that you want to take, so make wise decisions in his righteousness, not in our own. And then he requested the Lord would work vengeance upon those who were given him this bad counsel and advice. He says, destroy thou them, O God. And specifically, let them fall by their own counsels. So these guys are setting up traps and trying to push David into. He said, let them fall into their own traps. And that's kind of a theme throughout the Psalms. Cast them out in the multitude of their transgressions. Cast them out. Cast them out of the nation. Cast them out of society. Cast them out of this world. Cast them out of God's presence because of the multitude of their transgressions, for they have rebelled against thee. But let all those that put their trust in thee rejoice. Let them shout forever because thou defendest them. So you've got an action. So David's praying for this action. Let those that put their trust in thee. So that's who they're talking about. Those who are putting their trust in God, let them rejoice and shout for joy because thou defendest them. So for those that are putting their trust in you, remind them, show them that you're defending them, and give them that joy that they can rejoice, even when hard times are going on. Also, he's praying, let them also that love thy name be joyful in thee. For thou, Lord, wilt bless the righteous. With favor wilt thou compass him as with a shield. So that for thou links back into let them also that love thy name be joyful for them. So you've got the description of who are the people. You got the people that are described two ways. Those that put their trust in God and those that love thy name. That's the who. What's the action he's praying for? Let them rejoice, be joyful, shout with joy. And what are the motivation for that? the recognition that God's defending them and that God will bless the righteous. It says, with favor wilt thou compass him as with a shield. And in this case, we have the negative imagery of being encircled around by enemies, the 10,000s. Here, the Lord is compassing you around. He's encircling you. And that word shield, I don't know if shield really captures it, because the root word comes from a word that means a thorn or prickly. So you can imagine that he has put, a massive hedge around you. And often I think of a hedge, I think of kind of the nice bushes that if you really pushed your way through, you get through. But think of like those nasty holly bushes that if you fall in, you're not getting through and it's going to hurt. And so you've got a hedge about you of God with these, really intense prickly, things that are keeping you safe. With favor wilt thou compass him as with a shield. A shield of defense. Alright. And as I thought, given that it's 10 till, I don't think we'll have enough time to do a good job on Psalm 2. I did want to make it through some of those others. I will work on getting a handout prepared and ready for next time.